Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After more than a decade of headlines about America's obesity epidemic, the number of Americans considered obese seems to be leveling off, not dropping, but also not increasing at the rapid rate we saw in the 1990s and 2000s. Still, there's no celebrating at the Federal Centers for Disease Control, which says 35% of American adults are far too heavy, and the CDC says obesity remains common, serious, and costly. Meanwhile, New Hampshire's numbers offer a mixed picture. A recent study of Granite State third graders shows an impressive drop in obesity. Still, among adults, much has changed in a short time. In the year 2000, just 16% were obese. Now, that number stands at 27%. Today in The Exchange, the latest research and thinking around obesity, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour joining us from Hanover, Diane Gilbert-Diamond, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. She's also at the Norris Cotton Cancer Center. And Diane, good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Terry Johnson, Director of Healthy Eating, Active Living NH at the Foundation for Healthy Communities. And Terry Johnson, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, before we get into some of the latest research and the latest projects that both of you are working on, just real quickly, Terry, please, what's the definition of obesity?
So obesity is based on a measure of body mass index, which is a ratio of somebody's height to their weight. And in terms of normal weight, a body mass index of 25 to 30 would be normal. And anybody that has a 30-plus body mass index would be considered obese.
So it's not a particular look at, you know, your body type, you're big boned, you're small boned, you have a lot more muscle to fat. I mean, there are some subtleties there. This sounds pretty basic.
Yeah, well, it is. And some of that is related to body mass index. But generally, there has been research done, and there are charts that show that generally, depending on how big or small bone size you are, that definitely there's a correlation between height and weight.
There's been some criticism, Terry, of this measurement, that it's not nuanced enough, that you kind of plug in height, weight, gender, and you're done. What about people who might weigh a lot but be very fit? The idea that we should just do something a little bit more subtle than just this body mass index.
Well, definitely in terms of overall wellness and health, it's more important that if somebody does have a body mass index, say, that puts them in the obese category, if they're physically active and they're eating healthy, then they're likely going to be a lot more healthy than somebody who is not. So.
How do you measure obesity, Diane? Same way or something else besides body mass index? Because, again, this has been around for a while. Some people aren't so sure they like this measurement.
Sure. So in adults, we tend to use body mass index. And, again, over 25, a BMI over 25 is considered overweight, and a BMI over 30 is considered obese. But for children, they grow at different rates. So BMI alone can't be used. So we use CDC growth charts. And given the child's age and their sex and their BMI, we look up whether they're overweight or obese.
Yeah, and I've seen those growth charts. Every time I go in for a pediatrician visit with my kids, they show where they are on that chart. So for kids, it's a little bit different, it sounds like, Diane.
Yes. Yes, for kids it's a little different because kids grow at different rates. So you need to compare the child's BMI to the healthy growth trajectories.
So definitions of obesity still linked to BMI. Another question about defining this. Terry, too, first, is obesity a disease or a condition?
It's really a risk factor.
So a risk factor,
yeah,
okay.
And there are some varying opinions. A while ago, obesity was designed by one, it was designated by one academic institution as a disease. And but generally, it's looked at as a risk factor, you know, which is a risk factor for heart disease, for diabetes, and other types of chronic disease.
Pull that together a little bit more for us, how it could be a risk factor for those other diseases that are the scary diseases that we worry about.
Sure. Research shows that, for example, people who are more obese are at a greater risk for diabetes, for example. So there is a correlation between overweight and obesity and things like diabetes, even certain types of cancers. And it's just that research basically bears out that people who are more obese also have these other chronic disease conditions.
Heart disease as well, Terry. That's a biggie, right?
Heart disease, blood pressure. Yes, absolutely.
And is the link because when you're carrying around all that extra weight, your heart and your vascular system just have to work that much harder? It's like picking up, you know, an extra bowling ball or two? I mean, is that the connection?
Well, there is some connection between that, but obesity is also an indicator of how healthy of a diet that you have or how physically active you are as well. So we know research also shows that the more physically active you are, the healthier diet that you're eating, that you're less likely to be overweight or obese as well.
And Diane, I've heard some people call it diabesity, in other words, that strong link between diabetes and obesity. Can you sketch it out a little bit more for us, though, just sort of what happens A, B, C, D?
Sure. So about 80 to 90% of people who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes are also obese. So there's a very strong connection between obesity and diabetes. And what happens is when you gain that extra body fat, your cells are stressed and your cells release these molecules that make them less sensitive to insulin. And insulin is the molecule that causes blood sugar to come out of your blood into cells. So when people are heavy, they're less able to bring blood sugar out of their blood, and their blood sugar levels are not controlled well. So at first, your pancreas starts putting out more insulin and can help regulate your blood sugar still, but eventually it just can't keep up. So that's how obesity leads to type 2 diabetes.
Wow. And how about the connection between heart disease, which we talked about mm-hmm. a little bit, and high blood pressure? Again, how does being obese, you know, step by step, lead to those scary conditions?
Mm-hmm. So I think you touched a little bit on it. When you are carrying around this extra body weight, it is harder for your heart and your vascular system to keep up. So part of it is just carrying around that extra weight. But in addition, your fat cells actually release molecules that lead to inflammation. And those molecules wreak havoc on your whole body. And new research, emerging research, suggests that those inflammatory molecules, as they go through your body, also lead to heart disease as well.
And we're hearing more and more lately how inflammation itself is linked to all sorts of ailments that people have mm-hmm. these days. Can you be, Terry, healthy and obese? You touched on this earlier, but...
Yes, you can be healthier, definitely. You know, again, if you're, you know, more physically active when you're overweight or obese, or you're eating a healthier diet, then that's much better than if you're not doing those two things. You're likely to be a lot less healthy and more open for chronic disease conditions as well if you're not physically active or eating a healthy diet.
And we're talking about obesity this hour, but can you be overweight and healthy? You know, some people say, hey, I may be overweight, but, you know, I work out 3 times a week and I eat my salads and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, I've been working in wellness and health promotion for many, many years now. And, you know, back when I was working in worksite health promotion, you know, we did a lot of testing on employees in some of the wellness facilities that I managed. And you know, what we saw was that somebody who was active but obese had a better cardiovascular level or a better, you know, uptake of oxygen, for example, than somebody who was at a normal weight or what would be considered normal with their body mass index rating. But they weren't as healthy from a cardiovascular perspective, and science bears that out.
Our phone number here on The Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the issue of obesity after years of headlines on the obesity epidemic. We're looking at some of the numbers that indicate this condition, the number of Americans with this condition might be leveling off among some populations, including kids here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. What do you think has caused this dramatic rise in obesity in our country and in our state just in the past 15 or 20 years? What do you think might help turn the corner on this? Do you think society has been too focused on this, that we should focus on overall health instead of a BMI number or number on the scale? Again, we'd love to hear from you. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. And Diane, Terry Johnson, let's go to the phones. And Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Frankly, I've had a battle with, let's say, overweight. I don't want to call it obesity. And I came up with, a number of years ago, a draconian method which worked for me. I basically eliminate red meat, no desserts, unless it's a fruit, and no cookies. I was addicted to cookies. I could never just have one, and then I would eat the whole package.
But the other thing,
and the reason it works for me is that I'm also kosher. So all my life I've grown up with some, like, certain rules, certain things you can't eat. So it's not a big deal about these rules that are very straightforward and work for me.
Just sort of extending those kosher dietary rules to no cookies, no red meat. What do you think, Terry?
No, I think that's great. That's fantastic. Because one of the issues that our society has gotten into over the years, and one of the things I think that's driving obesity and chronic disease, is that, you know, we are, you know, the population, one, is consuming more calories than they're burning. So it's that energy expenditure equation. And number two, we're eating more fats, we're eating more carbohydrates that are laden with sugar, and so basically our diets are out of balance. And so, you know, not eating as much meat is a good thing, for example. Cutting back on the cookies, that's a great thing to be doing, Steve.
Well, and we're going to do a whole program on the whole meat issue on Thursday, given what the World Health Organization said last week. Do you want to jump in on Steve's point as well, Diane?
Sure. I think that cutting out cookies and high sugar foods is a great way to lose weight. And it's great that you have the self-control to do that. I think that for each person, it's different. Some people find that they're not able to sustain a diet where they cut out their favorite foods. So it's really an individual level problem in the sense that people need to find individual solutions that work for them.
Steve, thank you for calling in. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, as we look at some of the successes that we've had among children with this issue, often the talk turns to school nutrition, school lunches, and in some cases, school breakfasts. With us now on that piece of the puzzle is Sherry White. She's administrator of the Bureau of Nutrition Programs and Services for the New Hampshire Department of Education. Sherry, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, most people have heard of the big push by First Lady Michelle Obama a couple years ago to make school lunches healthier. Couple questions around that. What's the role, first of all, of school lunch in overall child nutrition, Sherry?
Well, as far as school lunch goes, you will find that for the numbers of children who eat school lunch daily, there are a large percentage of them who may need that meal because of the fact that their families are unable to purchase foods for their children to bring into school as far as a cold lunch is what we usually call them goes. And so the school meals do provide a place for these students to find a healthy meal or meals because there are a number of meals that are served throughout the school day to students.
So for some kids, it's the best meal of the day.
For some kids, it could be the best meal of the day. You're absolutely right.
How prevalent are school breakfast programs lately, Sherry? I've heard a lot about this.
Yes. In New Hampshire, we do have a program where we are starting to work with schools to proliferate the school breakfast program. Traditionally, in New Hampshire, the school breakfast program has been fewer in numbers. However, we are seeing an increase, and most especially an increase in the numbers of students that are being fed in already existing programs.
So talk, if you could, please, Sherry, about the role you see school nutrition programs, breakfast and lunch, playing in terms of this obesity issue that we've been talking about.
Sure. So, there has been, and if people have followed this, there's been a number of studies that have been done on the school lunch program and its possible connection or not to childhood obesity. And it was maybe about 10 years ago they started. And some of these studies did find that school lunch could have been a contributor to childhood obesity. So Congress enacted what was called the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, and this act was really an unprecedented act because it changed so many things. It did revise the school nutrition standards, and some of those standards included the increase in the quantity of fruits and vegetables that are being served, and most definitely also the whole grains. So now there's 100% whole grains being served in the schools. And as we heard from that last caller, change is so difficult in changing a person's eating behavior. And so think about changing the eating behavior of, you know, thousands of kids in school. If schools had not started making the changes early on, then they were met with some challenges. One of the biggest challenges was that the vendors did not have the product that the schools needed for conforming to the new rules, and it took probably about 2 years for a new product to come on board. That particular item hit hard with the whole grain piece. There was also complaints about increased food waste.
Yes, I've heard that. Lots of fruits and vegetables just being dumped.
Sure. So, and that issue was the biggest at the high school level, more so than the other levels. But schools are reporting to us now that the issue is becoming less as the middle school students matriculate to the high school level.
Really? So they're getting used to it?
Yeah, I think that, not that I think, but what I've been hearing is that, what we've been hearing most especially is that the kids are starting to get used to the changes, which I think is shows that there is some positive. And we also have seen a decrease in the numbers of reimbursable meals that were served to kids.
What does that mean, Sherry?
Reimbursable meals are the meals that conform to the USDA nutrition standards.
Okay, so you can get reimbursed for those, yeah.
Sure. And we saw a dip when the changes first came around. And for the last couple of years, we have seen a slight increase as they go. So really, we are seeing some positive things. And the positive things that we're hearing in the office, that helps to support what we're hearing as well.
We've heard, last question for you, if I could, Sherry. We've heard some schools saying, I think Londonderry is the example, you know, forget it, the rules are too strict from the feds, kids aren't eating it, and we're just not interested anymore. What would you say to districts that are looking at that and going, oh, which way should we go here? I mean, hang on, it gets better, or what would you say?
Sure. So first off, we talk to the individuals to let them know about some of the things that could be affected by dropping off from the National School Lunch Program. One of those things is the monetary piece because of the reimbursement that they receive. There have been two that have dropped off, and of those two high schools, it's typically a decision that they have to make based on the student population that they have.
And Sherry, I'm going to let you finish up that thought after a short break, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're taking another look at the obesity epidemic, many years into America's public focus on this. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. We were talking with Sherry White, administrator at the Bureau of Nutrition Programs and Services for the New Hampshire Department of Education, about the school lunch and breakfast program, attempts to make it healthier, to help with this obesity epidemic among American children. And Sherry White, I did want to let you finish up that point there, that two New Hampshire high schools, I think you told us, have dropped out of the program, saying that the new rules are just making the food unpalatable. Kids aren't eating it. It's not worth it. I asked you what you would like to say to other schools that might be considering the same decision.
Sure. Just to also add to that is that we have other programs that aren't public schools who have the program working within them, too. Some of them are called residential child care institutions. And these are alternative schools. In these schools, we have seen a number of them drop off, but we've seen a number of them come back onto the program again because they're finding that the monetary piece, as well as the following of the healthy nutrient standards, was of benefit for the population of children that they serve. So there's two sides to the issue, and it does take a school a very long, long time to make the decision as to whether or not they want to drop off the program.
Are there changes that schools could make within these strict federal guidelines to make the food a little more palatable so that you don't have as much dumping?
Yes, absolutely. So What's happening is, and again, I go back to the change piece. It takes a while to change somebody's appetite, or not appetite, but somebody's taste.
Sure.
And so it's just going to take time, I think, really, for students to get used to, you know, a new way of eating. And
just like adults, right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, Sherry, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Sherry White, again, she's with the New Hampshire Department of Education, where she works on nutrition programs. The number for you to join our conversation as we take another look at obesity is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. With me for the hour, Diane Gilbert-Diamond, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, and Terry Johnson, Director of Healthy Eating, Active Living NH at the Foundation for Healthy Communities. And both of you, we are going to talk about adults a lot as well. But your thoughts, Terry, first on just this, well, a little bit of a bumpy road for school nutrition programs as they try to participate in reducing obesity.
Well, as Sherry pointed out, there are a number of factors as well that drive that, economic and just, you know, in terms of the behavioral patterns that our society has adopted over time in terms of eating as well. But there's a couple of other things that I want to point out, things that are being tried in schools to really change that trend. And, you know, for example, the more that schools are getting children involved in doing taste testing with foods, being involved in planting community gardens and working to help the chefs, the food services directors institute those foods into the school menus, actually having a say in what foods go into school menus.
Really?
As well.
Some kids get to work with the school nutrition folks and tell them what to serve?
Absolutely, yeah. There are some really cutting-edge programs that are happening in our schools now where, you know, and kids are learning a lot more about the benefits of healthy fruits and vegetables when they're involved in planting and harvesting and then, you know, even helping some of the food services directors, you know, not just choose the foods but actually select the menu items. Once you get children involved in that, it really helps them to gain ownership of healthier eating.
You know, Diane, so often when we talk about this, we do focus on school lunches and what they should include and whether the standards are good enough or too tough. What about other influences, though, on kids and their food choices? I mean, so much of it is what happens at home. So much of it is, you know, what happens with their friends and so forth.
Sure. Well, my research largely focuses on food advertising and the huge impact that has on children's food choices. So I think that The food industry spends about $1.7 billion advertising to children under 11 years old. And they're not advertising healthy foods by far. They're advertising junk foods that are full of sugar and poor in nutrients. And I think our research shows that those advertisements have a direct impact on how much kids eat.
Wow. So give us an example of the types of foods that are being advertised and how successful it is.
Mm-hmm. So the food industry advertises primarily sugar-sweetened cereals, sugary beverages, candy. Those are prime foods that are marketed to little kids. Yeah, and in our lab, we show kids food ads or toy ads, and we find that during half an hour, children eat about 60 calories more when they're shown the food ads versus toy ads.
Do you want to jump in there, Terry?
You know, and Diane's absolutely right that in terms of food marketing and advertising, that has a huge impact. But there's a couple of other factors that I want to add to that as well, too. So if you look at that third grade study, it was a Healthy Smile, Healthy Growth. Healthy Smiles, Healthy Growth Survey conducted by the Department of Health and Human Services.
And this is new, actually, right?
Yeah, they did the first survey in 2009, and the follow-up survey showed data that indicated, as you said, obesity in third graders between 2009 and 2014 dropped from 18% to about 12.4%.
That's a big drop.
It is a big drop. But I think what's really important to point out is, you know, what the impact of the environment in which people live, social indicators, social factors as well. So if you dive down into those numbers, you'll find that obesity levels among children who are in schools with 50% or greater free and reduced lunch participation is 9% higher than those in schools with less than 25%, which indicates that, you know, children who are coming from lower income houses are living in neighborhoods with higher levels of racial and ethnic minority populations, that they're struggling more than our wealthier and middle-income populations.
Okay, and speaking of brand new research, in a minute, Diane, I also want to ask you about that new report from NIH about a gene that predisposes people to obesity. But let's go back to our listeners. And the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Nicole in Madison. Again, on kids, I want to share this with you. Nicole says, I'm fortunate to have my children see a practitioner that does not really mince words or split hairs when it comes to children, BMI, etc. Over the years, she has told me that most physicians will not address diet, weight issues with their patients because of fear of losing that client. So I want to ask both of you about that. But here's the second part of Nicole's email. She says, regarding BMI and charting children's growth, I always say, if that chart is comparing my child to other kids today, I'm not really interested. I grew up in the 70s and kids were all skinny. One or two children in a whole district might have a slight chubbiness, but that wouldn't even measure today. 2 years ago at a well child check, basically was told you should see every rib on a kid. That is normal. Again, when I was a growing child, every kid showed a rib. So two important points from Nicole. And Diane, I'll turn to you first about the doctor role. She says her doctor does not mince words when it comes to children and BMI. I have read, though, that, Diane, you do need to be careful or thoughtful about how you talk about this. What do you think, Diane?
Yeah, I think that pediatricians have a very important role in helping parents to know when their child is overweight. And it's crucial because when a child's overweight, they're very likely to become an overweight or obese adult. So we know that it's hard to help kids lose weight, and therefore we try to help kids grow into a weight. If a child's a little bit heavy when they're younger, if the parent can help the child to choose healthier foods, become more active, we hope that the child will then grow into their healthy weight. Because as they get taller, if they're not having a rapid weight gain, they can then reach a healthy BMI as they get older. So pediatricians have a very important role, and it is hard. It is hard for a pediatrician to tell the parent that their child heavy, but it's crucial that they do so.
When you say pediatricians need to help, how do they do it in a helpful way? Because, again, I have read, I think there was some new research that said, especially with preteen girls, if you tell them that they're fat, instead of being helpful, it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's such a hard problem. And I think that the focus really needs to be on health. How can we help the child to have a healthy activity level every day? How can we help the child to eat foods that are high in whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, low in refined carbs, and really focus on having the best diet possible, the best level of physical activity for a healthy life? We can all benefit from that, no matter what our weight is.
Just be the best you that you can be. I'd love to hear from you, too, on this, Terry. Maybe to Nicole's second point regarding BMI and growth charts. She says, if that's comparing my kid to other kids today, I'm not really interested given the overall more heaviness of kids today.
Right. I think it's better to not look at it so much through the lens of comparing your children to other kids, but really looking at them individually and where they fit within the body mass index scale. And also, I think it's, you know, really important to look at, you know, what are their behaviors? Are they physically active? Are they eating a healthy diet? But, I think it's, you know, not as helpful to be focused as a society on comparing both adults or children in terms of how they look and their weight.
Of course, it's human nature, though, too. I mean, you can tell people not to do it, but boy, I hear kids talk, you know, look at her, look at him, and so forth. Yeah. What do you think about the new studies, Terry, about the psychology of this, especially with preteen and teen girls? Very tricky. It turns out that shaming young girls about their possibly overweight or chubby, as Nicole, our emailer, says, mm-hmm. bodies actually turns out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well,
it's actually unhelpful.
You can be. I mean, there can be so much. If you look at society, if you look at advertising, you know, generally, you look at models and supermodels and clothing advertisements and that sort of thing. And you'll always see the very almost unhealthily thin models that are, are being portrayed in those ads. And that, you know, with social media and, you know, all the media out there, that puts a lot of pressure on younger girls to to look a certain way, and then they also, there's so much pressure in school, in high school in particular, right, from a peer perspective, to keep up with your peers in terms of appearance.
Excuse me. And yet American kids are heavier than they have been, so is that, maybe they feel the pressure, but it doesn't seem to be changing their habits.
And in some cases I think it's actually encouraging, unhealthier habits as well, too, because, one of the things that the third grade survey looks at as well is not just obesity and overweight, but it also looks at children who are not eating enough, who are not taking in enough calories or eating healthy. And so now you're looking at, issues like, unhealthy eating patterns that lead to being too underweight and, I'm trying to think of some of the terms right, but bulimia, for example, as
well. Or anorexia.
Or anorexia are some of the results of that. So you've got to look at both sides of the scale.
A lot more to talk about, but I also want to go back to our listeners. Again, the number here on The Exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments about obesity, some of the new thinking around it, new research, new numbers that show some slight improvement among some populations, 1-800-892-6477. And in Hampstead, Sherry is on the line. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi there, how are you?
Fine, go ahead, Sherry.
Okay, so I had a question about the designation of fat deposition as either an apple shape or a pear shape. It always used to be that the pear shape was always the better or deemed better than the apple, meaning more fat on the hips than on the belly, and I wondered if this was still true.
That's a good question, and I have heard that too, Sherry. Diane, did you hear Sherry's question? What do you think?
Yes, so the apple shape is when people tend to deposit fat around their midsection, around their bellies, and the pear shape is when they tend to carry the weight on their hips. And it is thought that the apple shape leads to higher risk for heart disease and diabetes. So
the
pear shape is considered healthier. Well, it goes back to the what we were talking about, how the fat can release various inflammatory molecules and hormones. And the fat around your belly tends to be more active than the fat that's stored around your hips.
That's really interesting. So if you weigh 200 pounds, but it's settled more around your hips, you're a little bit better off? Is that what you're saying, Diane?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And going back to the question of how do you actually measure obesity, some people use waist circumference rather than total BMI as a way to measure obesity because it gets to that idea of carrying extra weight around your midsection.
For that very reason. Okay, Sherry, thank you very much for the question. Here's an email from Robert in Epsom. He says, why is this problem tolerated if it is a problem rather than a fashion statement? Robert says, shouldn't insurance rates that people have to pay be based on their risk profile if obesity is not defined as a disease? Robert, thanks for the question. Terry, what do you think?
Well, there are some employers that are doing that they, literally are providing incentives or, for example, people that aren't living as healthy a lifestyle or that have, more risk factors, smoking, obesity, they are paying more for insurance or they're required to pay more for insurance premiums. But
really?
Yeah.
I know people have talked about that for a long time.
And that is the case with some employers. But personally, I feel like that's negative reinforcement, and I think it's much better if we focus more on positive reinforcement and really encouraging people to change their behaviors. I think people are more likely to if they're, for example, if they are, awarded with fitness center memberships if the employers are allowing benefits to be used for fitness center memberships or that employees have flex time at work during their workday that can be used for exercise, for example. I think the more positive environment that you create, the more overall impact you're going to have on changing people's behaviors.
And those programs have been around for a while, Terry. You and I have talked about them before. I see people at the Concord YMCA, for example, state employees filling out a book and you get a certain amount of credit on your insurance and so forth, or you get a little payback or something. And yet we still see those high obesity rates.
Because it's
these have been around for a while, these incentives.
Yeah, because it's about so much more than that. And I think something to really look at in terms of the environment and the conditions around people and how much those affect people's ability to live a healthy lifestyle. So if you look at in terms of health outcomes and the contributors to that, basically clinical care, access to health care and quality health care is about 20% of the equation. 80% of the equation is really about the physical environment, the built environment. Does it support walking? Do you have access to healthy food? Social and economic factors, like do you have access to good employment? Are you living in a low-income situation? Do you have, less safe neighborhood that you're living in? And then health behaviors. Between health behaviors, social economic factors, and physical environments, 80%. That's 80% of what is accountable towards health outcomes in our society. So how our communities are designed, the foods that are made available to students in schools, make it easier for people to make healthier choices.
But
society is surrounded by factors that don't contribute to healthy choices.
So if you live in an unsafe neighborhood or you live in a safe neighborhood but you're nervous about sending your kid outside to play, or you're nervous about walking downtown, or you're nervous about riding your bike because you're afraid somebody's going to be texting while driving and hit you while you're on your bike, then you just don't do it.
No, you don't. And I was just in a level of stress traffic mapping session down in Nashville, which looks at perceptions of bicyclists and pedestrians, and not just in terms of the infrastructure, but also the safety. And a partner down in Nashville described one area, one little neighborhood of Nashville as ground center for crime in that, and people will not walk. I mean, generally people will not walk or let their children go through that area alone.
All right. We'll talk more after a short break and take a lot more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's an obesity update. After years of headlines on the obesity epidemic, the number of Americans dealing with this condition seems to be leveling off, especially among some groups like kids. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What do you think has caused the dramatic increases we've seen in obesity in our country and in our state just in the past 15 or 20 years? What efforts do you think are helping to turn the corner on this? We'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Diane Gilbert-Diamond, you know, just before the break, Terry talked about the huge importance of environment, you know, walkability, safe places for people to play, easy access to good food, et cetera. What about genetics, though, Diane? Some brand new research just came out from the National Institutes of Health about a gene that predisposes people to obesity called the BNDF protein. What is this, Diane, and how does it work?
So just to go back, scientists estimate that about 40 to 75% of obesity is attributable to genetics. But that can't explain, our genes haven't really changed over these last 30 years. So that can't explain why obesity rates have climbed so much. So what we believe is that some people are predisposed to respond to environmental factors. So as the environment has become more obesogenic, as physical activity has decreased, how food has become more prevalent, how food cues have become more prevalent, people who are predisposed to respond to those cues gain more weight. And BDNF is one of those genes that can predispose somebody to put on extra weight.
So we've always had this gene, 40 to 75% of us, that predisposes us. But as the environment around us becomes more, you called it obesogenic? Is that what you said, Diane? I haven't heard that before, but I understand what you're talking about.
So we say obesogenic.
Obesogenic.
So environmental factors that can lead to obesity. And I should correct, I didn't say that 40 to 75% have that risk factor for that gene. I'm just saying if you put in all of the genetic factors together, scientists think that explains 40 to 75% of why people become obese.
I see. So if you look back at yearbooks from, you know, 40 years ago, 60 years ago, you see a class of 100 kids, you know, maybe one kid is obese. Now you see a lot more. But you're saying it's not that we as human beings have changed, it's that our environment has changed.
Exactly right. So we have always had the same genetic makeup for recent history. But it's just that as the environment brings us more high-fat, high-sugar foods, and as we become more sedentary, some people are that were likely to become obese but didn't have the environmental factors that led them that way are now becoming obese. So, for instance, in my lab, we're looking at another gene called FTO that's highly associated with obesity. And we find that children who have the risk version of FTO respond more to food advertisements.
Wow.
So kids who don't have any copy of the risk allele, they see food ads and they don't overeat after them. But kids who have two risk alleles, who have two versions of this high obesity gene, they overeat a lot more after seeing food ads. So again, they both have the same environmental cues, but some of the kids are genetically predisposed to respond to those cues.
So what are the implications of the discovery of these genes and that strong correlation you described, Diane?
Yeah, I think the implications are a paradigm shift, whereas before we would think that you have two kids and one kid can walk past the brownie and the other kid can't, and that means that one kid has much more self-control than the other. But now I think another way to think about it is it takes more self-control for the one kid versus the other. So because the one kid is genetically predisposed to respond to these cues, it actually is harder for them to resist those cues. And to me, that helps shift some of the blame, some of the burden away from that individual child and says that we really need to think about societal or community-level responses to this obesity problem.
Yeah, child or adult.
Probably. Or adult, yeah. Exactly. So the same genes also play in adult obesity. Exactly. My research just focuses on children.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Marie is waiting in Chester. Hi, Marie. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I worked in the health fitness, mostly fitness, for about 42 years. I trained gymnasts. I worked for the Department of the Navy. I did corporate fitness.
Wow.
Training, all of that stuff. And what I found is it's complex factors. No amount of exercise in the world is going to counteract a bad diet. It will not. You can go on the stair beast for 30 minutes, you burn 300 calories, you eat your french fries, it's gone. people sit all the time. Like when I was working, I drove an hour to work, drove an hour back, sat for a couple of hours at the computer. You're not burning calories like we used to years ago. So our occupations are difficult. And then you have a parent who's got kids and, you know, they're up early, they're driving them to school, they're bringing them home, they're doing homework, they're bringing them to sports. It's now 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and you're like, you want me to exercise? So time is difficult for people. Children don't cook. They don't prepare their own foods. They don't go grocery shopping. So it's the parents feeding them. So it's a good part of the problem. And the last thing I want to say, it's a gotta-wanna factor. If you want to do it, that might work. But most of them don't. What do you mean you want me to give up all my cheese? Or what do you mean, you know, I can't eat as much chocolate as I want to? So they want to lose the weight, but they don't want to do the work. You know?
So, Marie, this is real interesting. And you've been in this field for 40 years. So,
yes.
You know, a lot of this hasn't changed. You know, people have never wanted to give up their treats.
Yep.
What do you think has changed, though, Marie? It sounds like you're saying people are just running around and not taking the time to cook and eat properly. Is that the change that you've seen in your 40 years in this business?
They sit more and they have less time to spend on, let's say, you know, it's supper time. It's so much easier to go grab a pizza or whatever because you've got to get the kids to the sport. They don't have a lot of time. I'll give you one quick example. It was a single parent that worked two jobs, and we were trying to get her when I was in corporate fitness to lose some weight. She said, you know, I have 11 o'clock at night, I get to sit down for half an hour and watch the news. That's how much time I have.
Yeah.
We stuck an exercise bike in front of the TV. So 30 minutes she pedaled, and she modified her diet. She was able to lose like 30 pounds.
Wow.
That's a lot of discipline. Most people will not do that.
Sure. Well, Marie, great to hear from you. Terry, what do you think?
Well, Marie is describing, I think, some of the key and really noticeable outcomes that are occurring in our society, people being less active because they're so busy. For example, but I really want to describe, if you look at the trends for obesity and chronic disease over the last 30 or 40 years or so, they've been going up, up, up. It's become an epidemic. And while there's not strong research yet to point this out, I just want to point out some of the other things that have changed during that time as well. So over time, over the same period of time, you look at how our communities are designed. They've, even in New Hampshire, they become much more sprawling, more spread out, making it more difficult. I mean, the more you're able to live near the town center, the more you're able to safely walk and bike to your key destinations. To
if you think
groceries.
It's safe, some people perceive it as unsafe.
They do. And also, if you look at what's happened, Diane touched a little bit about the changes in the food industry as well, too. But even if you look from a policy perspective, you're seeing that big government subsidies are going to large commodity food producers, large agribusiness versus small farmers who are producing, healthier foods and vegetables in New Hampshire. The average farmer makes around $8,000 per year, gross income. You can't make a living off of that. So we really need to, you know, institute policies that will support that. Transportation systems have become more and more designed for automobiles rather than bikes and pedestrians.
That's shifting, though, Terry, somewhat, right? You see complete streets programs and bike lanes and so forth, little changes.
You are, and as a matter of fact, right now I'm working with a statewide coalition that we're lining up sponsors and legislators to help support a complete streets bill at the legislature, which ultimately would require that all state highways and roads are designed with all users in mind, not just cars.
Let's take another call. Marie, thank you for that one. Real interesting. And Ginny in Wolfboro, go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. I'm participating in a study called My Circadian Clock. It is being done by a Dr. Panda at the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California. And this is done through your smartphone, and it is tracking everything you eat, everything you drink, and their research has shown in mice that changing the duration during the day that people eat will change their risk toward obesity and other diseases.
You mean duration, like taking longer to eat? Is that what you mean, Jenny?
No, I mean, like, the first thing you eat in the morning is at 8 o'clock, and the last time you eat at night. So duration during the day. They said that the majority of people eat for 15 hours or longer during the day and consume less than a quarter of their calories before noon and a third of their calories after 6 p.m.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. You know, this is an ongoing discussion. Boy, Diane, I have seen back and forth on this in magazines and books and so forth 100 times. This question of, you know, is it better to consume most of your calories earlier in the day than later in the day? People often look at the French who, you know, seem to have a lot of fun eating but are not overweight, and they have that big noontime meal. Does this make a difference? I've read some studies that say yes, 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 and others that say, you know, don't worry about it, just overall do a good job.
Yeah, I think the jury's still out about the timing of the day and how that affects weight. So, you know, I thank the caller for participating in that research, because I think her involvement and the involvement of other participants really helped move that research forward. But what is known is that sleep is very important for weight gain. So people who get inadequate sleep are at higher risk for weight gain. And there are biological reasons for that. When you have low sleep amounts, your hormones that control appetite and feeling full are really disrupted by the low sleep. Also, as the previous caller mentioned, when people are sleep deprived, they're less likely to be physically active.
When
people, yeah, they're too tired to act to be physically active. And it's also thought, kind of going to this when in the day you eat, when people don't sleep very much, they're often staying up late and may consume a lot of extra calories in those late night hours. And also, I just wanted to touch on going to the idea of the French and, you know, eating this big midday meal and their weight. Another thing that the French do very well is that they eat slowly, they appreciate the food, they think about the food, and research suggests that if you're mindful of what you're eating, if you're paying attention, then you tend to eat less and feel more satisfied from that meal. So I think that there's something to that, to kind of slowing down and focusing on your food while you're eating rather than picking up the, you know, the fast food and eating it in the car on the way to work. Taking time to slow down and actually taste your food can make a difference.
So dashboard dining doesn't fill you up?
No, not the same way as dining in a nice setting with your family over a good home-cooked meal.
Well, and you mentioned this earlier, Terry Johnson, the impact of child poverty and the connection to kids being overweight and generally adults as well. Draw that connection a little bit more for us, please, because the old image of poverty is someone who's, you know, starving and doesn't eat enough.
Yes, and I think one of the best ways to really depict this is if you look at how you know, our foods have changed throughout the years. You're looking at less healthy processed foods. Commodity foods are made available in much greater quantities than they were before. And they're also more affordable than, say, healthy fresh fruits and vegetables and grains. And so what you're seeing is that people who are living in poverty and racial and ethnic minorities, they're not necessarily able to afford as easily the healthy foods. And so they're eating a less healthy diet as a result of those changes. And that also, you know, those are laden with calories, and which also can increase obesity.
They may also have less access to bicycles,
yes,
or gym memberships. And, you know, in New Hampshire, you know, you're kind of stuck inside sometimes. I mean, it may not be able to afford the ski passes and the mm-hmm. the snowshoes and so forth. So there's other
which is why it's so important that we really focus on changing how our communities are designed and really putting more funds into designing roads that support bicyclists and pedestrians so we can fit it into our daily normal routine lives.
Let's take one more call, and this is Celia in Brookfield. Hi, Celia. Go ahead. You're on the air. We got about a minute left, Celia.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the your guest's comment about the genetic a predisposition to
sure.
not having the self-control and not being able to walk by the brownie.
Uh-huh.
I've been happy all of my life and have, you know, fought this battle all my life. And I can remember specific times when that was absolutely true for me, and I was almost stunned or awed by a person that was with me that could actually not even think about what we were looking at and not partake of it. I always considered that a flaw in myself, so I appreciate that there's now some kind of, I don't know, affirmation that I'm not the bad person, that my self-control is not really the issue, that maybe there's something else going on.
Well, Celia, thank you very much for calling in, and good luck with this struggle,
you.
As you put it. And so, Terry, there's some information that's useful for her.
It is. I think, you know, so often as a society we're so much, you know, accusing people of choosing not to live a healthy lifestyle. And there are so many other factors that are involved, as we pointed out today. And so, you know, it's important that we look at how the environment supports that. It's important that we look how genes affect obesity and desire to eat healthy and so on.
So if you know why, then you can kind of move on.
Absolutely.
From there. Well, both of you, this has been great. Terry Johnson, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Terry Johnson, Director of Healthy Eating, Active Living NH at the Foundation for Healthy Communities. And Diane Gilbert-Diamond, thank you also very much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Diane Gilbert-Diamond, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. She's also at the Norris Cotton Cancer Center. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.